nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right. Well, everyone, welcome to today's Nano 501 seminar. We have Professor Roy with us, and he's going to talk about design in the nanometer regime, process variation, and next week, same time at MSEE 239, we'll have the next lecture of the two.
Right. Thanks. So what I'd like to do today is talk about some of the concerns in the designing in the nanometer regime. In particular, I'll talk about process variation today, and next week I'll talk about leakage variation, leakage, and leakage tolerance. So what are the problems that you face in the nanometer regime? One of the main problems is exponential increase in leakage current. So if we look at what's been happening in the previous technology generations, 1 micron or so, the ion to ion ratio was pretty good, and designing was a lot simpler. As we keep on scaling the technology, you can't get anything really free. As you keep on scaling the threshold voltage of the transistor, turns out that subthreshold leakage component increases. And as you keep on scaling the devices, the oxide thickness and other dimensions, there are other components of leakage which also become quite important. And as shown here, there are several different components of leakage that are really important in the nanometer regime, and I'm talking about the silicon nanometer regime. And today it turns out that in a high-performance processor, the power dissipation due to leakage can be almost of the order of about 35 to 40%. So certainly one has to do something about leakage current when you're designing in the high-performance for high-performance computers. In the non-silicon domain, again, we're not going to be talking much about that, but it turns out, again, it's difficult to maintain a reasonably good ratio of the ion to IOF. And it turns out that once leakage becomes sort of about 50% of the total power dissipation, then, of course, the way we've been doing scaling doesn't make sense. One has to do something about it so that you can keep it certainly below the 50%, below 50% of the total power dissipation. The other important issue, and that's what I'm going to be focusing on today, is process variation. And it turns out, again, if you are down to the regime of like 90 nanometers or 65 nanometer node, there are several different variations that come into picture. Turns out the length of the transistors that you might be designing may not really be what you have designed for. There's going to be a variation, a distribution. The threshold voltage of the transistor, which is related to the flat band voltage, again, possibly is going to have some distribution. And these distributions can be quite large when you go from one die to another. And those kind of variations are called, inter-die variations, variations between different dies, the parameter variations between different dies. And earlier, actually, at one time, there was a good paper from Texas Instruments, which basically showed there are four different components of parameters that one needs to consider for for process variation. Those were the W, the T-aux, the length of the transistor, and the flat band voltage. But it turns out today, in, for example, 65 nanometer technology or so, you can have random dopant fluctuations or line edge roughness and so on. And it turns out this random dopant fluctuation or line edge roughness would make two transistors which might be sitting right next to each other to be have different threshold voltages, let's say. And that can cause severe problems as we'll see in the nanometer regime, especially when you're designing, for example, SRAM cells. Why SRAM cells? Because those are usually lowest geometry transistors, and random dopant fluctuation can affect such devices quite a lot. A slide that I borrowed from Intel showing that for a 65 nanometer, this was actually, if we look at it, what we really see is that if you count the number of dopants in the channel, and in the 65 nanometer regime, you are actually, the number of dopants in the channel can be less than 100. So you can almost count the number of dopants, and since they're randomly placed, turns out there can be a good amount of variation. Another topic which is actually quite a bit of interest today is reliability, and I'm going to briefly talk about it towards the later part of the talk, temporal degradation in performance due to negative bias temperature instability. And it turns out over time, in this particular case, we're talking about the PMOS transistors, they would degrade, the threshold voltage would degrade, and what can happen is that your frequency also over time can degrade, and unless you do something about it, there can be failures. So one of the major problems is process variation, and that, again, that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And if you don't do anything, if you do a nominal design, let's say, a design with nominal threshold voltage of the transistors and so on, nominal length of the transistors and so on, it turns out that you're going to get possibly a design, but you may not be able to meet the performance of the design coming out of every die from different wafers, coming out of different wafer lots and so on. So in other words, what can happen is your parametric yield might degrade quite a bit. So as I said, one of the issues is variations. And this is another curve that I actually borrowed from Intel again, showing for 150 nanometer CMOS transistor, there's a good amount of variation. This axis shows the number of dies versus normalized IOF, the off current. And it shows that the off current coming out of different dies can vary quite a bit. Now, off current also tells us exactly how good the transistors are. If the transistors have higher strengths, meaning thereby that they are stronger, in that case, the leakage is usually higher. And if they are actually of lower strength, usually the leakage is lower. And again, what one can do is one can try to do the design in the worst case corner, making sure that all the dies certainly work at a particular frequency of operation. In other words, what you're really doing is you're doing a over-design. But we'll see later on that if you do such a design, your power dissipation is going to be really large. So one needs to do something about it. So what I'm going to talk about first is on-chip memories, and there are two reasons why on-chip memories are very, very important. First of all, the memories actually do take up a large section of the core today. So if you really look at today's processors, it's almost like 70 to 80% of the die area is taken up by the cache memories. And that size is actually steadily increasing over different technology generations. And second, variability is a major problem in a memory, especially because of the fact that the transistors in the memories are usually of minimum geometry to keep the size of the cell small. And hence, we'll see that there can be failures. And these are hard failures that we're going to be talking about. When it comes to logic, we'll see we'll have a different kind of failure, and that failure is more mainly related to delay failures. But in this particular case, due to variations of parameters like threshold voltage or length of the transistors, one can see a different kind of failure, read failure, write failure, and so on. And we'll see that in a minute. So let's, before going into the details of it, let me talk a little bit about different types of variations. And one that we're going to be concerned about is inter-die variation, meaning thereby that if you look at different dies coming out of different wafers, it turns out there can be a good variation in the, for example, the strength of the transistors coming out of die number 1 versus die number 100, let's say. And that distribution in general, and we can model it as, let's say, a threshold voltage variation. And that threshold voltage variation versus inter-die variation is shown here. This is actually a cartoon showing that the distribution can possibly be, for example, a Gaussian distribution. And on top of that, let's say that I actually pick up a particular die, and for that particular die, the threshold voltage is right here. So on top of that, what we're going to be having within that die is some local variations. And that local variations can be due to random dopant fluctuations or line edge roughness or due to some other causes. Now, as we'll see later on, that when we look at a 6-transistor SRAM cell, these kind of variations can lead to failures. So the total variation now, the threshold voltage variation, is going to be given by the global variation and the local variations. So let's look at an SRAM cell in a little more detail and try to see what happens when I try to read or write into the cell, and assuming the fact that there can be variations. So now if you're talking about intra-die or within-die variations, if I look at these different transistors, PMOS transistors and MOS transistors, they can really have different threshold voltages. And let's assume that that can happen due to random dopant fluctuation. Now, due to that, what can happen is that the strength of these NMOS transistors can become lower, the strength of these access transistor can be higher, and we'll see that that can lead to certain kind of failures. So let's say that I'm trying to read from the cell. So let's take an example of read, and let's say that I'm trying to read from this particular cell. On the right side, I'm trying to read a 0. On the left side is a 1. So the way the reading is done is pre-charge these bit lines to logic 1, and then I turn on these access transistors. So I turn on these access transistors. As soon as I turn it on, since this is logic, this is precharged 1 and this is 0, this voltage would try to go up a little bit. So as long as these voltage do not go beyond the trip point of this inverter, we are okay. However, it might so happen that the threshold voltage of these transistors have changed in a direction as shown here. Green means, you know, lower VT. These red ones means higher VT. In that case, the trip point of this inverter has changed. So what has happened is that this voltage, which is going to rise a little bit, if it goes beyond the trip point of the inverter, then there can be a failure. Though you might end up reading it correctly, the next time you read it again, there would be a failure. Okay? So that would be called a destructive read failure, and one has to certainly do something about it. And this is really happening not because of any hard failures in the in your transistor. This is really happening due to process variations. One can also show, and I'm not going to go into the details of it, one can have write failures. What are write failures? And again, due to the strength of the transistors moving in different directions, we might have hard time writing into the cell, meaning trying to make the 0 into a 1 and this 1 into a 0. So that would be a write failure. You can have access time failures, and you can also have hold failures. What do I really mean by hold failure? In the standby mode of operation, sometimes you'd like to put the memory in a low voltage state to reduce the leakage current, reduce the power dissipation, and so on. And it turns out, again, if you scale your supply voltage down, VDD down to about, let's say, 300 to 400 millivolts, due to these variations, again, one can see failures. So if there were no variations, of course, things wouldn't be really that difficult. So what we're really talking about is looking at, if I'm looking at a SRAM cell or a cache, then I need to do a good amount of testing and I need to do some sort of repair. Otherwise, what's going to happen is there can be a good number of faulty chips and some working chips. So what we really need to do is figure out a way so that we can do nominal design. And in the nominal design, we know that we can have failures. So is it possible that by looking at certain parameters in your die, we can determine which process corner it's in and then take some corrective action by trying to move these chips from this side to this side using some circuit means or architectural means. This is an interesting slide which shows that process variation and how bad it can be for SRAMs. So if I look at, for example, this was actually on a 64K cache, and we did a large number of Monte Carlo simulations, and this was actually for a predictive technology model, 45 nanometer technology model, with a sigma VT of 30 millivolts. And what we see is that, one other thing I should mention is that for the 64K cache, there was no redundancy and no error correction. So if I don't have error correction and redundancy, it turns out only about 33% of the chips are going to work. You know, the rest of the chips, they really had some sort of failures, and the failures here I'm talking about are, again, failures due to process variations, like read failures, write failures, and so on. So, and it also shows that the number of failures can be really large. You know, can have a large number of failures. Now, of course, the question, of course, is the fact that if I do bring in redundant rows and columns, if I do bring in error correction circuitry, would it go to close to 100%? And the answer actually is no. You can only get up to about 70 to 75%, we'll see later on. So one has to certainly do something else to get your yield up to 95, 96% and so on. Again, the basic idea, we'll be going back and trying to analyze these SRAM cells and try to do some sort of self-correction. But it turns out, if I look at the global variation, if I pick up a chip from this side, which is the high VT side, let's say, high VT corner, this particular chip can actually have access failures and write failures. And if I have a chip on this side from the low VT side of the die, one can show that, not the low VT side of the die, but the low VT corner, turns out one can show that you can have read failures and hold failures. Interestingly enough, of course, on this side, there are not too many read failures. On this side, there are not too many write failures. So write failures and the read failures as expected do not go hand in hand. So what can we do about it? It turns out what we'd like to do is, if I pick up a chip from this side, let's say this is possibly going to have a write failure. Is it possible that I push this guy somehow? And on top of that, I'm going to have some local variations, remember. So what I earlier said is that the failures that I was showing happening is really due to local variations. But in reality, these local variations lead to failures, but they're accentuated really by which corner of the die that you're in. So is it possible that I push this guy die somewhere here and try to reduce the failure rate? And that's exactly what I'd like to do. So this would be called a post-silicon technique after I've done fabricating the chip. Of course, there can be internal circuitry which is going to figure out which corner the die is in, and I'm basically looking at the inter-die variation. And depending on that, I'm going to try to move it towards the nominal side so that my, in this particular case, the write failure would decrease. However, if the chip is on this other side, of course, I'll try to push it towards the nominal side to decrease my read failures and so on. So we looked at a number of cells and a cache array and analyzed the failure probability, which is shown on this axis, versus the inter-die or die-to-die VT shift. So when I'm right here, which is zero, meaning that the nominal corner of the die, turns out the cell failure, let's look at a cell failure probability, which is shown in yellow, the cell failure probability is low. On this side, of course, which is the low VT side, my read failure probability is high. On the right side, my write failure probability is high. And somewhere in the middle, the failure probability is low. But the interesting thing happens is when I look at an array, this is actually for one particular cell, and this is for an array. The difference between the array and one cell is that I now have introduced redundancy in the array. So now with redundancy in the array, of course, some failures can be taken care of by the redundant rows and columns. Of course, beyond a certain point, when my redundancies are not able to take care of any more failures, my failure probability increases a lot, right? However, in this region, of course, my failure probability is pretty low. The question, of course, is what can I do about it? And this is actually a cartoon showing that, again, the same idea, failure probability versus, you know, inter-die VT shift. And on one side, I have read and hold failures. On the other side, I have access time failures. Is it possible that I... And if I really look at the distribution, by the way, the axes don't seem to be actually right, but it gives you the basic idea that any chips which are falling in this side is not going to have is going to have read failures. This side is going to have, again, the right kind of failures. And if I don't do anything, there can be a good number of chips which might fail. So is it possible that if I have chips on these two sides, is it possible that I push them a little bit? What do I really mean by pushing? I'll let you know. But if I can somehow push them a little bit and have them in this region, of course, then I can improve my failure probability a lot. Similarly, I'd like to push these guys from this side to here so that my failure probability again improves. And this is actually for write failures. I got to be a little bit careful. Why? Because I don't want to push this guy all the way to this side, because then in that case, of course, what's going to happen is that I'm going to take a write failure and make it into a read failure. I don't want that. And similarly, I don't want to push this guy on this side and make it into a write failure. So I got to be careful about that. But if I am able to do such a thing, of course, then this cartoon basically shows that I can get an improvement in the failure probability, and in terms of yield, my yield is going to increase quite a bit. So that's a basic idea. So how can I do that? Now, one way of doing that, if I could figure out which process corner this guy's in, right? So on the right side, in the region C, I'm in the high VT corner. Is it possible that I apply, for example, certain body bias to change the threshold voltage of the transistor? So I can have monitors, let's say, and they can be leakage monitors or delay monitors, and these monitors would tell me which process corner the chip is in. And based on that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to apply a body bias, and in this particular case, apply a forward body bias. When I'm in the nominal corner, I do not apply any body bias, but on the if I'm in the low VT corner, I apply a reverse body bias. And thereby, again, what I really do is I make my failure probability lower and my yield would increase. Now, what kind of body bias I'd like to apply? I can apply the body bias to the PMOS transistors, or I can apply the body bias to the NMOS transistors. So in this particular case, I'm applying the body bias to the NMOS transistors. And the reason, of course, is the fact that the NMOS transistors do play a much more important role in the access time and the read-write of the memory cells, and hence you can get a much more improvement in yield if you are actually applying a body bias to the NMOS transistors as opposed to the PMOS transistors. By the way, the PMOS transistor body bias would certainly improve the yield too, but the yield improvement is going to be a lot higher if you apply to the NMOS transistors. And by the way, all NMOS transistors, since if I'm assuming it's to be triple well process technology, certainly I can apply the bias to all the NMOS transistors, and that should be good enough for this entire chip. A few other things which are important is that I'm trying to sense basically the inter-die or die-to-die corner that I'm in, and based on that I'm applying a bias. So now if I really look at, for example, the sigma over mu of one particular cell, the SRAM cell, then what it's going to have, and which basically tells me how sharp the distribution is, it turns out that's going to be given by, you know, let's say that sigma x over mu x, and that's for a particular cell. But if I look at the array, leakage, let's say, of the array, then the sigma over mu of the array is going to be given by 1 over root n sigma over sigma x over mu x. And so what it really says is that the theory of large numbers come into picture, and if I look at the array, then I'm going to get a much sharper distribution. And hence, what you really saw is this is actually some of the simulation results showing that if I'm in the low VT corner versus the high VT corner, I'm going to get a very quite a bit sharp distribution of these arrays. And remember, on top of this inter-die variation, I'm also going to have intra-die variation. So what it tells me is that by monitoring the inter-die variations, I would be able to actually discriminate the chips which are in the low VT corner versus the chips which are in the high VT corner or the nominal VT corner. If I were to do that for a single SRAM cell, that would be difficult because the sigma over mu for a particular cell can be quite wide. So how do I apply to a memory now? So I have an SRAM array, and I have an on-chip leakage monitor, which basically determines which process corner the chip is in. And based on that, I determine a few reference voltages. These reference voltages tell me which, you know, should I apply a reverse body bias or should I apply a forward body bias. And a body bias selection circuitry based on these reference voltage would determine the required values of the forward body bias and the reverse body bias. And in this particular case, we're using a digital body bias, meaning thereby that I'm using one value of forward body bias, one value of reverse body bias, and so on. And that gives me quite a bit of improvement in the yield of the design. This has been actually implemented in a 130 nanometer process technology, a 128K SRAM cell, SRAM array. The process technology did allow triple well process, but we didn't really use that triple well process feature. The number of transistors implemented were about 7 million. And the interesting results from the simulation really shows that if you're in the low VT corner versus the high VT corner, it turns out that you can get a large improvement by applying for, this basically shows the y-axis, shows the total number of failures. And if you're in the low VT corner or in the high VT corner, what it really shows is that the self-repairing technique that I just presented can give you a large improvement. Of course, it's very, very difficult to get 100% yield because we are talking about distributions, and in this particular case, we are talking about a Gaussian distribution for the VTs. What happens if I were to use, you know, continuous body bias? You know, we are using a digital body bias, three values of body bias, which is a reverse body bias, forward body bias, or no body bias. It turns out continuous is certainly going to be better. You still can't get this 100% yield, but continuous is certainly going to be better than these three values. But it turns out this blue curve, which shows these three levels of body bias, that can actually give you, you know, reasonably good improvement compared to the continuous body bias. And the problem with continuous body bias is, of course, going to be the fact that it's going to be a complicated circuitry. This slide basically shows some of the measurements with hold failure. And again, what it really shows is that for this 130 nanometer technology, that self-repairing technique certainly helps in reducing the hold failures, and quite a bit. And these are actually measured results, and these are not simulation results for that 130 nanometer technology. Again, showing that it can be an effective technique for improving the yield of memories. The technique that I just talked about is a post-silicon technique. Again, the idea in that post-silicon technique was that I'm going to sense after fabrication, I'm going to be sensing which process corner that I'm in, and then based on that, I'm going to take some corrective action. Again, a very similar post-silicon technique can also be applied to another fast memories, and this is a register file, and I thought I'll just briefly describe that. So this is actually a portion of a register file which is shown here. What is really important to note is the fact that you don't have to go into the details of the register file, but what it really looks like is a dynamic cell. And in this dynamic cell, what you really do is, or like a domino cell, what you really do is you have a clock. You pre-charge this particular node, which is shown here. You pre-charge this node to logic 1, and then they'll conditionally discharge depending on what you have stored in this memory and if you are actually accessing that particular cell or not. So it basically looks more like a OR kind of logic style. Now, interestingly, what happens is that in such a logic style, I need a keeper transistor. When everything is off, for example, if this is 0 and all these nodes are, you know, storing 0 values, let's say, what can happen is there can be leakage current flowing to these guys. And if I pre-charge this node logic high, if my leakage is too high, and if a number of these are present, if my leakage is too high, this voltage would go down. And if this voltage goes down, there's a possibility that the trip point of this gate I might go below the trip point of this gate and I can have switching. And that kind of switching is pretty bad because there's no way of going back to that previous mode because it's a dynamic logic and it's a pre-charge kind of logic style. So what's the solution? One of the solutions to the problem would be to increase the size of this transistor, this PMOS transistor. And if you increase the size of that PMOS transistor, then this node would be able to hold the value better to logic 1. The only problem is that in an evaluation mode, when I'm evaluating my clock is equal to logic 1 and I'm trying to evaluate 3 logic gates, and let's say that I have a path on, in that case, this transistor and this pull-down path might fight with each other and your performance is going to go down, right? So why not try to do something else? In the low leakage corner, of course, it's not a problem, right? I can keep a low keeper. And since my leakage is low in the low leakage corner, I don't have much of a problem. In the high leakage corner, of course, I need to keep it high, right? This has to be large, but there's no way of determining ahead of time which is the high leakage corner and which is a low leakage corner. Again, so it has to be a post-silicon technique. I need to actually sense the corner that I'm in, and based on that, I have to do something else. So in this case, I'm not going to be applying body bias. In this case, I'm actually going to be adaptively changing the keeper size. So now what it's possible to do is that I have a programmable keeper or adaptively sizing the keeper. And turns out I have some extra logic here, which basically does nothing other than the fact that based on this condition when I sense, basically, let's say if I'm in the low VT corner and the high VT corner, I decide that, hey, if I'm in the low VT corner, I need W to be equal to only this keeper size should be W, then I only turn this transistor on. If I need 2W, of course, I turn this transistor on. If I need 3W, I turn these two transistors on. How do I determine that? Based on these B values. Where do I get the B values from? By sensing which process corner that I'm in, right? How do I sense it? In this particular case, I have a leakage sensor. I'm not going into the details of it. It's an analog circuitry which determines how much leakage do I have for that particular die, and based on that, I actually program it. So now, if my leakage is too high, in that case, of course, what's going to happen is I might use a 7W size for the keeper. If I'm somewhere in the middle, I might use a 4W size of the keeper. Does it really work? And this is actually the measured result. This was actually implemented at Intel in a 90-nanometer process technology. And some of the interesting results, I mean, my student Chris Kim was involved in this project work. And what it really shows is that, you know, there were some dyes, these are basically the different leakage current versus the transistor characteristic, IDSAT of the transistors. But interestingly to note is the fact that if I look at the dye count versus which dye had the keeper size of what, it really shows that a few dyes has a keeper size of W, a good number of dyes with a keeper size of 2W, and so on. So the technique certainly works. And what are the results of this technique? The basic idea is you're squeezing the distribution. Right? So if I look at robustness, and I haven't defined the robustness, right? Robustness meaning, I mean, what I'm really talking about is I don't want any failures, the kind of failures that I was talking about. So if I have robustness on this axis versus the number of dies, what I really see is that the yellow one is for this programmable keeper work, and white one is basically the conventional way of sizing. You have one keeper transistor, and hence you have a large distribution, wider distribution. This is a much sharper distribution as expected. And your robustness, there's a 5x reduction in the robustness of failing dies. And interestingly enough, because of this technique, since your when your leakage is low, your keeper size is low. When your leakage is high, your keeper size is high. Then in that case, of course, you also have an opportunistic speed up. And this particular case was about 10% or so. So that also requires that I change my design methodology a little bit. Okay, this is not normally what you do, for example, when you're looking at a design which is 250 nanometers, right? So now what I really need to do is a different way of looking at my design methodology. So what am I doing now? Nothing really changes on this side. Of course, I go up to the wafer test and so on. But after that, I need some sort of process detection. I need to detect which process corner that I'm in, right? And this can be some leakage measurement or some other kinds of on-die sensors, can be delay sensors, can be leakage sensors, and so on. And based on that, I take some corrective measures. And what are those corrective measures? Depends on the circuitry. So far, what we have looked at is memories. And in one case, what I really did is applied a body bias. I could have applied a source bias. And the other case, what I really did is basically program these programmable keepers, right? So again, depends on the kind of application. You can apply the proper kind of techniques. And finally, you go through assembly, test, burn-in, and so on. So now we have to introduce sort of a different way of process detection and process correction. And these are all on chip. Again, if I look at a die then, what would it's going to have is, this was actually the leakage sensor that we developed. So what can happen is that you take this leakage sensor and you put it in different sections of the die, and again, wherever it's required, and based on the sensed values, you take the proper corrective action. And that would be a good way of designing in the nanometer regime under process variation. Now, the technique so far that I talked about for the memory is basically a post-silicon technique, meaning thereby that I'm doing my design, let's say, under nominal conditions, and then based on sensing which, you know, corner that I'm in, I'm taking the corrective action. Now, certainly one can try to also do a design time technique, right? Which is meaning thereby, now it's not gonna be self-correction later on after fabrication, but it's gonna be more of a design time technique so that I can avoid failures. And how do I avoid the failures is the interesting thing to know. Now, this is actually a little bit different technique, which is more of an architectural level technique for the memories. And I thought, since I talked about circuit level techniques, it might not be a bad idea to talk a little bit about some of these architectural level techniques. So the basic idea here is that I have a cache, right? I mean, this is my cache. And what I can do in that cache is that cache has data blocks. And this is a direct map cache, as an example. It doesn't have to be a direct map cache, but I have a direct map cache here. And each block, let's say, of 256 bits. Now, for this particular example, I have, you know, 512 rows. You can change it. This is just an example. But what can happen is that I can try to determine, you know, if any one of these blocks is faulty, and if this block is faulty due to the kind of process variations that I'm talking about. So what I also have is a built-in self-test circuitry. Now, this needs modification from the standard built-in self-test because it might be using March test, and I need a modified March test, and I'm not going into the details of it. But it turns out that I have a built-in self-test circuitry which tests this memory and figures out if any one of these blocks is faulty or not. And that information, you know, built-in self-test circuitry, is kept in a configuration storage. So the configuration-based storage basically tells me that, you know, has this information whether this block is faulty or not. This block is faulty or not, or this block is faulty or not. It has this information. So now what happens is any time I have, these are actually the memory addresses, tag, index, and offset. So any time I'm accessing the memory, at the same time, what I'm really doing is I'm also accessing this config storage. Why? To figure out if that particular block that I'm going to be accessing, is that faulty or not, right? So in parallel, I do that. But as soon as I find out that particular block is faulty, what do? I have a remapping technique. So if this particular block is faulty, what I might do is I map it into this particular area, right? So that's one way of doing it. Now, what happens when I'm really accessing this block, right? Then I need some corrective action. So that may not exactly work the way I'm just talking about. It sounds too simple, but you know what it really does is that, yes, I have a remapping technique, and the remapping technique, if a certain area is faulty, it's going to map in there. What happens to that particular block? Because somebody else was going to be mapping into that block, right? So what happens to that block? Now, if I could do that, it turns out it can give me a large improvement, but I have to be a little bit careful in my mapping technique. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of the mapping technique. The basic idea is if 0, 0 is faulty, I'm going to map into 0, 1. If 0, 1 is also faulty, I'm going to map into 0, map into 2. If 1, 2, 3 are all faulty, then I'm going to map into 4. Now, if 1, 2, 3, 4 are all faulty, then of course I'm in trouble and I'm not going to do anything. I'll say that the data chip is faulty. But of course, this is for only one row, and similarly for the other rows, right? But there's one problem, and the problem is that let's say that I have a particular address. I'm storing D into address 1, and then I'm loading 2 and taking this into a register. Now, let's say that the location 1 is faulty. So if the location 1 is faulty, it turns out that I can map into location 2, right, for 1. The only problem is when I'm trying to load into location 2, there's going to be a tag match, okay? And that tag match basically says that, hey, I can write into that cell. But that would be wrong because that block has already been taken up by the previous instruction, right? So what do I do? It turns out the solution is reasonably simple. You can actually include, you know, 2 bits of your index into your tag. So your new tag is actually a little bit longer than the previous tag. And now, under such a circumstance, of course, what it really shows is that for the second case, there's not going to be a tag match, and you have to get the value from somewhere else. Okay? So that solves the problem. Remember earlier, again, let's not worry too much about these curves, but remember earlier what I said, that if I look at a 64K cache, and if I do not have any redundancy, if I do not have any ECC, my yield was about 33%. Now, for that 45 nanometer predictive technology with a sigma VT of about 30 millivolts, turns out if you put redundancy in and yield, and ECC in, then your yield goes up to about 77%, not 200%. Now, you can keep on adding redundancy, but remember that your redundant rows and columns might also fail, right? So beyond a certain point, it doesn't make sense to add more redundancy. But if you do remapping along with redundancy and ECC, it turns out you can improve the yield to about 94% or so. Now, by the way, this does not include any body bias or self-repairing technique that I talked earlier. So on top of that, you can apply any one of those techniques too. So these are independent techniques. And how many failures can you detect? Again, without going into the details of it, it turns out you can have large number of failures, and such a remapping technique is kind of interesting because it can handle a large number of failures. So what's the catch? I mean, none of the techniques are really gonna be, you know, perfect in all respects. So what's the catch? Your performance is gonna decrease, right? So why would the performance decrease? Because adaptively I'm changing the memory size, right? So if there's a failure, my size of the memory is actually reduced, right? So what happens? We looked at a large number of benchmarks, and these are the benchmarks that the architecture folks look at. And so we looked at a large number of SPEC 2000 benchmarks, and what it really shows is that we plotted the number of faulty cells versus the CPU performance, and there are actually programs to do that. And if you look at it, turns out using this technique, you can almost tolerate a large number of failures on an average. And at the same time, on an average, your performance penalty was about 2% for all these benchmarks. So that's not really too bad. Now, what we did so far is talked about memories. What happens in logic? Now, logic is a little bit better. In memories, you can have failures. In dynamic logic, you can have real failures. In logic, the things are a little bit different. You can have failures, but these failures are really due to delay faults. Meaning thereby that if I actually reduce my frequency, then things are going to work. So for some chips, of course, the frequency can be low. For some chips, the frequencies can be high. And that's basically the idea behind binning, right? So what happens is today, if you're fabricating let's say, a 45 or a 65 nanometer technology, and you're building a microprocessor, turns out some of these processors are going to work at a frequency F, and some of them are going to be working at a frequency F1. So let's say that you've designed something to work at 2 gigahertz, then some of those might actually work at 3 gigahertz too. And some of those would work at 1.5 gigahertz. And you have done nothing. It's only variations. And because of that, that might happen. But of course, what you'd like to have is that most of the chips that you're designing to work at the higher frequency, if you can. So can I do that? That's the idea. So in logic, what happens is and this is actually some simulations showing the number of dies versus delay, and this is again implementing the same function, but it turns out there's a good amount of spread, right? So now if you select your frequency to be somewhere here, then what happens is these dies are not going to work, right? So yield goes down. If you select your frequency and you're more aggressive and you select your frequency to be here, which is a better frequency, then your yield goes down even further, right? So that may not be, again, the best way of doing the design. So good way of doing design, we feel, is, okay, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be doing a nominal design. The basic idea, nominal design, there's going to be a spread, and let there be a spread. If I do a worst-case design, what's the problem? My power dissipation is going to go up, and what I can do is I can size my circuits also. That's going to increase my power dissipation for all chips. I can increase my VDD. Again, I'm going to get a better distribution, supply voltage. Again, my power dissipation goes up, and I don't want that. So my idea then would be to actually design with under nominal conditions, but make sure that if there are any errors, those errors would be predictable, and I can get around those errors by doing something maybe interesting in the architectural level, maybe adaptively changing my clock frequency, or maybe stretching my clock a little bit, or maybe even doing one cycle versus two cycle operations. They're all the same. So is it possible? Can I do that? But I got to make sure these two cycle operations do not happen all the time. The stretching of the clock do not happen all the time. So can I actually make sure that it doesn't happen all the time? Can I make sure that I'm able to do that? Okay, so that's basically this new paradigm of low voltage design that I would like to briefly mention, that it's possible actually to do such a thing, to get around those delay failures. Basic idea that I'm going to have a nominal VDD, and under variations, there might be some failures in some chips, but my design technique is such that I'm able to predict when such a thing is going to happen, and I'm going to get around that problem by correcting it using adaptively stretching the clock. So that's the basic idea. So is it possible? Can I do that? So let's start by looking at a cartoon, and this is actually path delay versus the number of paths. And what I really find is that, this is a cartoon again showing the distribution of the paths, path distribution. And in general, what would happen is that I'm going to pick up my, I'm going to decide to have my supply voltage to be somewhere here so that I have enough slack. And even under variations, there's not going to be any failures. So that's the normal way of designing, and let's call that to be design A, and I have some slack available within that clock period so that even under variations, I'm okay. So my idea then is, in this new design style, is it possible that I get a new distribution, a path distribution, which is a little bit different from what I've shown before, that I have a path distribution here, but I have a set of critical paths which are here. Now, what I'm really saying is that if I can make this set of critical paths predictable, and I know when they're going to be activated, and I know if they're not going to be activated very often, okay, then I can still select my VDD somewhere here or here or even here, depending on the situations. I can select my VDD such that for these ones, I'm going to do two cycle operations, and for these, it's always going to be one cycle operation. Or in other words, I'm adaptively stretching the clock. Is it possible I do that? And that's the basic idea again. For design B, there'll be some failures, but these are not really failures because I'm really doing two cycle operations for those, and I know ahead of time when this is going to happen, and hence I'm able to do that. So this is basic idea that this lets me actually, in other words, scale my VDD aggressively down. Okay, I can take care of variations. At the same time, I can scale my VDD down. Is it really possible to do it? And it turns out, yes, in a simple example, in a ripple carry adder, what one can show is that there's one single critical path from this carry all the way to the carry out. And for such a situation, can I break the carry? Is that path going to be active all the time? It turns out the probability of activation is given by the probability that these propagate signals, you know, P0 times P1 times P2 times P3 is equal to 1. Okay? And that probability turns out, if I assume that the input signals are only going to be 50% of the time 1, that probability is going to be pretty low. Right? So is it possible that by looking at some inputs, I can cut this logic? And it turns out it's possible. It's very, very easy. If I have 0, 0 at the input to this logic, then of course there's not going to be any carry propagation. I can extend it. I can look at 2 gates. So all I'm looking for is a carry kill circuitry. And it turns out in arithmetic circuits, in multipliers and so on, it's possible to do it. And we have done it in several other cases. So what's the advantage here? You know, in the first case, you can say, hey, I'm not doing this adaptive clock stretching. If I really have this VDD of 1 volt and a clock period, in this case, is 260 picoseconds, my critical path delay for this VDD to be 1 is 260 picoseconds, and I get a 13 microwatts of power dissipation using one cycle operation. However, let's say that I scale my supply voltage down to 0.8 volts, my clock, I'm not changing, I'm still keeping the same clock, you know, higher frequency clock. But my critical path delay has changed because of scaling of the VDD to 330 picoseconds. But the next critical path turns out is 260 picoseconds. So now what has really happened is that I can get a much lower power dissipation because of VDD scaling, 7.4 microwatts, but I have rare two-cycle operations to take care of these critical paths. So that's the basic idea. I can do it in arithmetic circuits. But most importantly, can I do it also in random kind of logic? And it turns out, yes, that's also possible to do it in random logic if you actually are a little bit innovative. And in this particular case, what I'm really showing is that given any function f, I can break that function into what's called Shannon cofactors. And these cofactors are, if any function f can be written in terms of x1 times this cf1, cf1 is a cofactor of f with respect to x1, cofactor of f with respect to x1 bar, what does it mean? I put actually x1 to be equal to 1 here, and that's basically my CF1. Xi equal to 0 here, and that's my CF2. And one can show, I'm not going to go into the details of it. Logically, that's actually consistent, and this represents this function. So what it really means is that I can represent this function in terms of Shannon cofactors. Interesting thing, either this is going to be active or this is going to be active. Both are not going to be active at the same time, right? Again, really means that I know which one is going to be active based on my input conditions, because that's how I've selected my splitting variable. In this case, the splitting variable is Xi. And then I select the output based on a mux. Nobody says I have to stop there. I can recursively do it, right? I can take CF1 and I can actually do a cofactor of CF1 with respect to some other variables. And so on, I can keep on doing that. And remember, the activation probability of this one is going to be a lot lower than, you know, this particular one, let's say. Why is that? Because I'm looking at more set of inputs, I'm decoding the inputs, and I know that this is going to be active only under certain conditions. And if I know the probability of the inputs, and I can take the worst case probability of these inputs, you know, let's say 0.5 or so. In that case, I can figure out which is going to be active and at what time it's going to be active. One thing I haven't told you is that there can be sharing of logic between these two stages. In that case, of course, I've got to be a little more careful. So what I can really now do is I can do Shannon-based cofactoring, and I can keep on factoring it in such a way that, let's say, maybe this is this turns out to be my critical path, or this may be my critical path, let's say. And what I haven't told you is how to select the splitting variables. It's not very important at the time, at the moment. It's basically a heuristic that one can use. But if I can actually do that, it turns out I can basically almost say that this is going to be my critical path, this is not going to be my critical path. And on top of that, I can size it. So maybe what I can do is I can size up this one, I can size up this block, I can size up this one, I can size down this particular block. In other words, what I'm really doing is I'm trying to create a slag between the set of critical paths and the non-critical paths. So if I go back to my previous thing, what I'm really trying to do is that I'm trying to create a slag between my set of critical paths and the non-critical paths. So that's what I did. All right, so now knowing the critical paths, when they're going to be active, I've sized it properly, and now I can use the technique of one cycle, two cycle, as I mentioned earlier. Got to be a little careful. I only looked at the logic part. right? In general, you can have latches. So I have logic 1 followed by logic 2 followed by logic 3, and in between I can have latches, right? And that would be sort of a pipeline that one can think of. And in general, most of the circuits would have that. You know, it's a pipeline logic that. Now, interestingly, any time I'd like to do a two-cycle operation here, I have to stall the pipeline. The pipeline has to be stalled because it can't take in new data. So I need some logic to make sure that I can stall the pipeline. I, based on my input conditions, I know when two-cycle operations are going to happen, okay, assuming every operation is one cycle. And then there's some decoding logic basically determines whether I should turn off the clock to these latches or not. Thereby, what I'm really doing is I'm adaptively stretching the clock. So if I know it's going to be two-cycle operations, I turn off the clock in the next cycle so that it doesn't get latched. So that's a basic idea. Interestingly, if you do these kind of techniques, the decoding logic overhead one can determine. And again, there are various ways of coming up with the decoding logic, the complexity of decoding logic, what should be the complexity of the decoding logic, and so on. I'm not going to go into the details of it. But interestingly, if you do such a technique, this is very interesting to notice that instead of 1 volt supply, I could actually use 0.85 volt supply, and I could get about 60% improvement in total power. That's leakage, dynamic power, everything included. Area overhead, not much, about 8% or so. Performance degradation, about 6%. Why did I get the performance degradation? Because of these two-cycle operations. Remember, I can possibly improve it at the cost of making these decoding logic a little more complex. And that would increase my power dissipation a little bit. So I'm taking advantage of a few things. I'm getting an improvement due to the VDD squared terms in my power dissipation. My leakage also improves due to scaling of my VDD. And at the same time, I'm making a trade-off with this decoding logic versus the area overhead and so on. This was actually implemented also in a 130 nanometer technology. And this is the fabricated chip. We also have some results of the fabricated chip matching reasonably well with the simulation results. Finally, in the next few minutes, I'd like to talk a little bit more about this logic and also about a little bit about NBTI. What one can also do is, I didn't talk much about it, I briefly mentioned the fact that I can do sizing, right? I can size up my transistors, and if I size up my transistors, I can get an improvement in delay. And if I do a worst case sizing of my transistors, then hopefully a good number of chips are going to work. But the problem, of course, is, as I said, your power dissipation is going to be too high and you're over-designing. So one can come up with possibly a good way of sizing your transistor so that your off-critical paths are sized down and your critical paths are sized up in such a way that you can get a reasonable yield. The difference between the previous technique and this technique is that in the previous case, I said, actually your off-critical paths are sized up a little bit. And your critical paths might be sized down a little bit. So this is unconventional. That was unconventional, right? Because I'm actually increasing the delay of the critical paths, and off-critical path delay I'm reducing. Why? Because I'm trying to create a slag between the critical and the off-critical paths so that I could do these one-cycle, two-cycle operations. In this case, I'm still talking about sizing up my critical paths and sizing down my off-critical paths so my power dissipation doesn't increase. So this is more conventional. And I can get some yield. So each of these stages in the pipeline would have some yield. The yield can be Y0, Y1, or whatever. So let's say that I've sized it properly so that I have area of A1, yield of Y0, area A2, yield of Y0, area A3, yield of Y0. The question, of course, is that a good idea to do the design? The reason is that in general, when I select the clock frequency of my design, it's really determined by which stage is the bottleneck. In this particular case, I need to figure out the bottleneck under process variations. The question is it a good idea to have yield to be the same for each stage? Now, interesting result is that probably not. So it turns out that if I look at this stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, is it possible that I change that yield Y0 from Y0 to Y1? So initially, let's say in a balanced stage, my yield is Y0 times Y0 times Y0. But in an unbalanced stage, let's say that I have yield of the first stage to be y1, the yield of the second stage to be y2, the yield of the third stage to be y0, let's say. But if I can ensure, if I have y0 times y1 times y2 to be larger than y0 squared, then of course I have an improvement. So what have I done? Under variations, a little bit of unbalancing might help, but you got to be careful. Why is unbalancing helping? The reason being, but under this condition, you have to remember that I'm keeping my area to be the same. I'm not changing my area. So the area for this design is the same as the area for this design. Why is it happening? In general, if I really look at the stage area versus stage delay curve, they're going to look somewhat similar to this. So depending on the slope that I have here, you know, is it possible that, you know, just by decreasing the area of stage A1 and increasing the area of stage A2, I get a much further improvement in yield in this second stage than this one. And this decrease in yield is not that bad for the first stage. If I can ensure that, then of course I have improvement just by unbalancing my delays a little bit. And that indeed is the case. Showing that for some benchmark designs, for a balanced design yield, which is balanced design is shown in blue, the balanced design versus unbalancing a little bit, turns out can give you better result. But you got to be careful. If you unbalance it improperly, then of course it's not going to give you the best yield, right? But the basic idea again is the fact that for any stage, I look at that slope, and if depending on how the slope is, I can decide to actually reduce the stage area of that stage and thereby reduce the yield, or I might increase the area of that stage a little bit so that I can get quite a bit of large improvement in my yield. So what I really wanted to show is that a little bit of unbalancing really would help, because we are talking about variations. And this is actually a little bit counterintuitive. And finally, in the next couple of minutes, I thought I'll just mention briefly that there are other kinds of degradation. So far, the degradations that we've been talking about are at time t equal to 0, and we're talking about spatial variations, right? Spatial variations in the threshold voltage, we're talking about spatial variations in L. We actually lumped everything into threshold voltage. Whether that's the best idea or not, that's questionable, but that's reasonable. But this degradation is really due to happens over time. And the reason, of course, is the fact that, you know, there can be various, there can be different types of degradation. You can have hot carrier injection, NBTI, which is negative bias temperature instability, and that turns out is one of the most important ones. Or you can have TDDB, dielectric breakdown. But it turns out this NBTI is actually one of the most important ones, and that basically happens because of the fact that over time and under stress conditions in PMOS circuits, your silicon hydrogen bonds might break. And due to that, what can happen is that over time, your threshold voltage might degrade. And the degradation of threshold voltage, again, what one can do is one can put sensors, and I'm not going to go into the details of the sensors, but one can actually try to detect such a variation over time. Let's say 3-year period or 5-year period, you have sensors in your circuitry, detect basically, hey, there's a variation, and my frequency is decreasing due to NBTI. Is it possible that I take some corrective action? What kind of corrective action? Very, very similar to that we talked about earlier. Could be body biasing, could be, again, adaptive sizing, or could be source biasing, any one of those techniques. Can I do a post-silicon technique? Or I can also do sizing. So that would be a design time technique. So can I do a little bit of, you know, over-design and improve my yield over time quite a bit. The basic idea again is if I look at the frequency over time, and this is actually a cartoon showing that over time the frequency would decrease. So if I were to actually come up with a new design technique or a design time technique, and this is not a, you know, post-silicon technique, but a design time technique, I'm going to do over design, but I'm going to do a slight over design such that at time, let's say 3 years or whatever, that I have my frequency is still good. And it turns out it's possible to do that. We actually implemented a Lagrangian relaxation-based sizing algorithm to do that, and that gives you a reasonable improvement. And we looked at 3 to 5 year period, and it turns out with an increase of about, you know, 7 to 8% in area, one could achieve a higher reliability, much higher reliability in terms of MBTI. And again, I'm not showing the results here. So in conclusion, what I feel is that the process variation or extreme variation in process parameters are becoming very, very important. So what you have to do is now you're designing under unreliable conditions. So you can think of your components to be unreliable. So how can you design with unreliable components? That turns out to be very, very important. And in particular, what we talked about is different types of techniques, post-silicon techniques or design time techniques, both for memories and logic, so that you know, we have an improved yield. Now again, every time we talk about yield, we can't just ignore the fact that timing is important and power dissipation is important, right? So certainly you need tools for estimation of yield, failure probability, and performance degradation, and of course power dissipation. So all these sort of things, you know, speed, yield, and power dissipation has to be considered for high-speed memory systems or logic. And I feel that both design and post-silicon techniques are required to improve yield. And if you go to, for example, you know, non-silicon technologies like, you know, carbon nanotubes or, let's say, other molecular devices and so on, there you might think of having, like, you know, source drain shorts or source drain opens. And in those cases, you need to talk about not just the variations. You can have variations in such a technology. You know, variations in the diameter of the tube would give you actually a different threshold voltage. But you certainly have to talk about hard failures. By the way, when we talked about some of the failures of process variations and we talked about bulk silicon technology, we talked about random dopant fluctuation as one of the intra-die variations. However, you might say, hey, if I could get rid of dopants completely, and if I have, for example, an intrinsic body device, can I get rid of all those variations? Now, some of the variations are inherent because I'm using technology where I'm using a wavelength of light which is 193 nanometers and my device sizes are really, you know, 65, 45, and so on. So I need lots of corrections. But on top of that, if I say, hey, if I could get rid of all the dopants, am I going to be any better? The answer is probably not, because you can think of these thin body SOIs like FinFETs and so on. Your body thickness has to be very, very small, right? But any variations in the body thickness is going to give rise to changes in the threshold voltage due to the quantum confinement effect. So again, possibly even in those technologies, things are not going to be that good. Right, that's all I have.
I think we probably have time for a question, maybe.
Sure.
Okay. All right.